Our first case this morning is 19-1484, Polaris Innovations v. Hershey. Mr. Phillips, let me just say at the outset, the panel decided to flip the order of these cases, and that was largely because we saw their procedure called threshold issues in both appeals, and we thought there was at least arguably more fulsome briefing in this case on those. So we decided we would hopefully be able to cover those procedural threshold issues in this case and not have to repeat them in the next one. So that's where we are. So just so you know, you might want to begin there.
Okay. thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, may it please the court. I would definitely like to say a few things about the claim construction issue in this appeal, but I will start with the procedural issue, as you noted. The board should have terminated this IPR when the parties filed a joint motion to terminate after they settled. While the board has discretion not to terminate when a joint motion to terminate is filed, a decision not to grant the motion should be explained. In this case, there has been no such decision or explanation. And in every other case in which the board has actually made a decision on a joint motion to terminate during an Arthrex remand, the board has granted the motion. And there are three such cases. We've identified them in our supplemental briefing. And in light of those cases, it was arbitrary and capricious for the board in this case not to grant.
The PTO also cited some counter cases, though, right, that it argued are more in line factually with the circumstances here.
The PTO, Your Honor, cited two cases, Apotex and Aristocrat, and neither case supports the board's position. In neither case did the board actually deny a joint motion to terminate during an Arthrex remand because of the fact that the solicitor had intervened on the merits in the appeal in this court. In both cases, the joint motion to terminate was just in limbo, as it is in this case, without a decision. And I will also note that in the Apotex case,
you're saying in those cases that that motion is still pending? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying there was no decision by the board on the joint motion to terminate. Now, in the Apotex case, it came up to appeal to this court, and the court reversed on claim on the merits. So the motion to terminate became moot. So it doesn't matter in that case. In the Aristocrat case, that is lagging behind this case, and there has been no substantive briefing on any issue, the termination issue or the merits issue.
Was the motion to terminate ruled on? It wasn't decided by the board at all?
No, Your Honor. Not in either case.
But you're not claiming that the board of the Patent Office doesn't have the authority under the statute to make a decision, whatever a decision, right? So that's a given, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So your argument is even though they have the authority to do that, is that reviewable by us? Or is it your view that it's an APA problem because they have to give reasons and explanations for what they're doing? I'm just trying to understand what your argument is.
Yes, at a very minimum, the board has to give a reasoned explanation for its decision to deny the motion. And, of course, we don't have a decision here, but...
How should we interpret what Chief APJ Bolick said in his order to you in this case, where he... as I understand it, found that the premise of your motion to terminate the IPR is untrue, given that the final written decision, the status of it is a fact, it's alive, and it's a real decision, it hasn't been vacated. And so, therefore, the premise of your motion has been overtaken by events. I guess one way to interpret that order is essentially denying it or declaring it moot, because the basis of it by happenstance has now been erased.
I believe it is correct to consider that commentary by the chief judge as an effective denial of our motion, but it was substantively legally incorrect. The motion was timely filed under 35 U.S.C. section 317A, which refers to the filing of the motion before a decision by the board. And that's exactly what happened in the three cases we've cited. There had been a final written decision. There was an appeal, a remand.
I guess what I'm wondering is what would be wrong with for the USPTO to say the status of the final written decision in this case, we understand, has been vacated by the Federal Circuit, but its status is still up in the air because we just filed a cert petition in this particular case in light of Arthrex. And now I think it's worth waiting and seeing if the final written decision comes back to life with the Supreme Court's decision. And so we're going to wait and to see what happens in that pending litigation. What would be wrong with that?
Well, of course, that's not what the board said at any point, and that would have been inconsistent with what happened in the three cases we've cited. Those three cases were in the exact same procedural posture as this case, in the sense that there was an appeal to this court, the petitioner settled out.
As I understand this case, this is the one where the USPTO intervened and defended the merits of the final written decision, and then after that, the USPTO filed a cert petition in this case.
That is correct, Your Honor.
What was the status of the board's final written decision at the time of those other cases you're referring to? My recollection is that at that point, when the board ruled on the motion, that the final written decision was still vacated.
That is correct.
Isn't that different? I mean, I understand your point. I think you make some point about the timing being arbitrary and capricious. But, you know, if you think about it, timing matters and can be arbitrary in many cases. What if a court issues a ruling that changes the state of, say, 101 law, and that impacts the case? That could be a situation where you could say, well, it's arbitrary because my case was decided the day after, right? So what is your response?
My response is that, you know, the board could have given those reasons in the other three cases. It did not. The board promptly granted the joint motion to terminate in those other three cases. And it didn't in this case, inexplicably.
I mean, but in this case, there was a final written decision that had been vacated but now was reinstated at the time that the board decided the motion.
At the time,
it was a final written decision on the record, right?
At the time when the board should have decided the joint motion to terminate in this case, the final written decision stood vacated.
So you're complaining about the timing.
Absolutely. And I will note,
what rule or anything do you have to rely on to say that they have to decide it by a certain time?
The APA, Your Honor. 35 U.S.C., I believe it's 706-2, says, I'm sorry, 5 U.S.C., I don't know, let me find it.
So wasn't this case, it was, okay, go ahead.
It's a rule that it's a statute that essentially says agency action may not be, quote, unlawfully withheld or unreasonably delayed. And to be clear, that's 5 U.S.C. section 706-1. But that's exactly what happened here. The board sat on our motion doing nothing for over a year with no explanation, no decision, and that's why we're in the circumstances we're in.
Can I ask you one other question? Is when I look at 317A, I'm not sure that it requires a final written decision. It says, unless the office has decided the merits of the proceeding. So how do you respond to that? I mean, even if the final written decision had been vacated, the office decided the merits. I mean, they might have to re-decide it, but if you think of that broad language, has decided the merits, as supporting, like, the timing, hey, if you're going to request a settlement, it shall be terminated unless, you know, we've gone so far along in the proceeding that there has been a decision by the office on the merits.
Yeah, the board actually addressed that in the other three cases when it granted those joint motions to terminate. And that's quoted on page 19 of our supplemental brief in this case. That's document 92. There the board explained, and I'm quoting, although we decided the merits of the proceedings and entered a final written decision, Federal Circuit has vacated those final written decisions, .. Under these circumstances, we determine good cause exists to terminate the proceedings. They could have and should have done the exact same thing for the exact same reason in this case, Your Honor.
Your time's short, but we certainly are sympathetic to your reaching the merits. Do you have any other comment on this board intervention thing?
One other comment before I turn to the claim construction issue, Your Honor, and that is the purported distinction here between our case and the other three cases where the joint motion was terminated really don't stand up to scrutiny, and it's not enough of a distinction to overcome the arbitrary and capricious standard. First of all, the solicitor waived the argument by not making it at the first available opportunity. Second, the board has never adopted that reasoning, certainly not in this case. And in the other cases that were terminated, the board never mentioned the solicitor's intervention on the merits as having any relevance to its analysis. Third, somebody always defends the board's decision in these appeals. There's nothing special about the solicitor in that role. There's no reason to credit the solicitors defending the merits of the board decisions any more than that of a private party who has real skin in the game. The solicitor does not screen the cases that it intervenes in when a party settles. It takes them all and intervenes uniformly, no matter how poorly written the board's decision is. Fourth, there's no rational reason to protect the solicitor's intervention on the merits of garden variety, patent-specific issues, as opposed to issues of broader significance, like the constitutional issue in this case. And then fifth, you know, it cannot be said that the fact that the solicitor has gone on record as believing that these claims are unpatentable supports denying the motion in this case. The board has already said that. You know, the office has already gone on record as saying this patent is, these claims are unpatentable. Of course, that depends on your view of the merits, and we disagree with that. So I would like to turn to the merits. So there are two possible meanings of the term memory chip in this art. It means either a packaged IC or an IC die. Those are two mutually exclusive meanings. In any given context, the term cannot mean both. And what does it mean in this case? Well, if you look at figure 2A, both experts agreed that the term memory chip is used to mean a die. So before your honors decide the claim construction issue in this case, ask yourself one simple question. How many memory chips are there in figure 2A of the patent?
Well, what is that? Why does that end the case? Don't we have numerous cases that say that you're not limited to one embodiment? You're relying on figure 2A. But why is that the be-all and end-all in terms of claim construction? Our cases say the contrary, do they not?
Well, first of all, figure 2A is the exact part of the specification that informs the reader how this document is using the term memory chip. And really, it's the only part of the, and its accompanying text, the only part that addresses that very issue. So it's not just an embodiment in that sense. It's the most important part of the document. And there's no other embodiment in this patent.
So you infer from the fact that there's a drawing that it's the most important embodiment and the claims are limited to it?
It's the only part of the document that talks about chips in relation to a memory component. There's nothing else.
But it's an embodiment, right? What makes it, what translates it from being just an embodiment, because it's shown in a figure, to being the only way to interpret the claims?
Well, keep in mind, Your Honor, that we're talking about a dependent claim, claim 2, which is necessarily drawn to a narrow special case of the invention. Of course, that's going to be an embodiment. The particular embodiment here is figure 2A. That is what claim 2 is directed at. So
Here's my problem. I mean, we started off agreeing that there's a well-established default understanding of this technical term memory chip. It's a generic term that can encompass one of two things, a packaged IC or a die. And so then the next question is, what is it in the intrinsic evidence, in your specification, that communicates that the patent drafter here has somehow redefined the understanding of memory chip so that it's narrowed down to just one of the two types of understood meanings for memory chip? And when we get to that, we don't even see the word die in your patent specification. We do see this very simple diagram of four things on top of each other, four rectangles on top of each other. But at the same time, that there's not anything, I'm afraid, that I can find that tells me that the patent drafter, under the broadest reasonable interpretation consistent with the specification, was telling the rest of us that it is only talking about and thinking about dies as serving as the memory chip.
3 points to that, Your Honor, and I apologize that I'm over time, if you'll indulge me. First of all, both experts agreed in this case that the way one of ordinary skill in the art would interpret figure 2A is that the chips are die, and the bigger box that encompasses them is a packaged memory component. Dr. Trdenek, NVIDIA's expert, said so. You can see that on appendix pages 1573 through 74. And of course, Dr. Shabilsky, Polaris' expert, said the same thing. That's noted on page 19 of our blue brief. The second point here, Your Honor, is that...
is there something about the nature of this invention, about this access memory controller or whatever it is, that demands or biases us to believe that, oh, the only way this is going to work is if the memory chip is a die as opposed to a packaged integrated circuit?
Yes, and before I answer that question, if I
and
may...
And if the answer is yes, where is that in your briefing?
Okay. Yes, the answer is yes. Before I answer that question, I wanted to finish my answer to your previous question.
It's up to Judge Prost.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. The other point I wanted to make is that here in this patent, the term memory chip, we know it's directed at a die, because not just because the experts agreed, because that other possible meaning, a packaged IC, for that, the term uses a different specific term. It always uses the term memory component when referring to the packaged IC. And that's why we know, and it's consistent everywhere throughout the patent, that's why we know that a chip in this patent does not mean that other possible meaning. And remember, there are two mutually exclusive meanings. You can't have the union of both. It means
okay,
either one
you,
or the other.
We're still limited in time. Why don't you go ahead and answer Judge Chen's last question.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. So the background section of the patent, that's column 2, lines 36 through 53, explain the problem that the inventors were faced with. At the time of the invention, multi-die memory ICs were just becoming commercially viable, and the problem is that you need extra control lines to access the individual die within the package, and so the invention here is directed to that. It's a way of sharing control lines for both control and address.
Column 2 lines what?
36 through 52 or 53, Your Honor. So that's the sweet spot that the invention is directed at. Claim 1 is overbroad. We're not defending that, but that's what Claim 2 is directed at. That's the invention. Thank you for the extra time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We'll restore a couple minutes of rebuttal. Let's hear from the office.
Good morning, Your Honors. I may please the Court. Omar Amin on behalf of the USPTO. Starting first with the termination issue,
Is Mr. Hirschfeld still an employee of the PTO?
He is not currently.
All right, so why is this called Polaris versus Hirschfeld?
I believe Mr. Brent will be substituted as a party. He will be the deputy director, and he will be substituted as a party once he clears conflicts.
Okay, where's Ms. Vidal in all this?
Ms. Vidal has a conflict. So you know, we submitted a motion to modify the caption because she has a conflict in this matter.
Okay.
So starting with the termination issue, the parties apparently do not disagree that the statute gives the USPTO the option whether to terminate or not to terminate. And so at this point we have Polaris' argument that the USPTO's failure to terminate its IP.
What's the status of the joint motion to terminate? So has it been denied, or is it still just hanging out there, unaddressed?
So the joint motion to terminate has not been formally denied. As Your Honor noted previously, it was addressed in the October 29, 2021 order, but it wasn't actually formally denied with that order. So it has not.
I thought in the document the board had said that the termination motion was no longer properly before it because of Arthrex.
That's
because the first written decision was reinstated after it was vacated.
So yes, Your Honor, that portion of that decision was responding to Polaris' argument in the joint motion to terminate. The termination was proper because Arthrex required a new decision. So it was responding to that argument, but that order was actually in response to Polaris' request for a conference call with the board about how to handle the remand proceedings. So it didn't formally deny the joint motion to terminate.
Should either Polaris or this court expect that the Patent Board is going to do anything further on this joint motion?
Well, Your Honor, the Chief Judge expressed his views on the joint motion.
Well, how do we have a final judgment if there's still a pending motion that could dislodge everything that's going on here? How is this properly before us at all?
Well, Your Honor,
in its entirety.
Well, Your Honor, the denial of the director review noted that the final decision is the final agency action. So Polaris requested director review. That director review request is principally based on the idea that this proceeding should be terminated.
That's fine, but my question is, there's an open motion. Presumably, we know the likelihood that it's going to go the other way, but it's still open. It hasn't been denied. So how do we have a final judgment? I mean, there might be a final written decision, but if there's still a pending motion before the board that could dislodge it or do something different, why are we reviewing it? Or what if the board would grant it tomorrow? We're wasting our time and the court's energy to decide something that could be mooted out by the granting of a motion, right?
It's certainly possible that the board would revisit it, but I think that depending on the instruction, the remand instruction.
That was a very spooky thing you just said. It's quite possible that the board could reconsider.
I didn't mean to
reconsider that order that Bolick issued a year ago.
So, and not reconsider that issue because again, that order formally responded.
Reconsider what?
So, if on remand, depending on the remand instructions, the board may have the authority to revisit the joint motion terminate. But if the remand instructions are to, for example,
have they finally resolved that? That was Judge Chen's first question, which is why I'm holding my breath here. Because you're saying there's still a pending motion that has not been either denied or granted, that's still open before the board.
I mean, one way to interpret what Bolick said was, under any reasonable reading of Section 317, once there's a final written decision, the board is not going to entertain any kinds of motions to terminate the proceeding. It can always consider one up until there is a final written decision, but once there's a final written decision in the books, it's not going to do it.
Is
that what Bolick was trying to say?
Yes, I think effectively it did deny the joint motion to terminate. It didn't actually enter the ministerial task of formally denying it, but as you know, I believe...
So it's no longer open and pending because it was effectively denied. Is that the office's position?
That is my understanding of the office's position. It is effectively denied, but there's no actual...
What you're talking about is if it goes back to remand, I mean, no further action, is any further action in your view required or necessary to put that question to bed?
under my understanding is that no further action is required. If the court requires, for example, additional explanation, then the board may have to provide additional explanation as to why the joint motion to terminate was denied. But beyond that, my understanding is that no further action is required.
Okay.
Unless the court has further questions on termination, I could turn to the merits.
Well, you want to talk a little, because your friend spent a lot of time and effort in his brief in here talking about, under the APA, the need for consistency here, and the board did not provide consistency because not only did this, what it did here, fly in the face of its previous determinations, but it offered no explanation as to why or how this case was different than those. So you want to respond to that?
Sure, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. These cases presented the USPTO a very unique circumstance. The USPTO was faced with the prospect of 100 cases being remanded, potentially requiring new decisions. And in that light, the USPTO did its best to weigh competing concerns. On the one hand, certainly there's the concern of encouraging settlement. On the other hand, we want to avoid wasting resources and avoid unwinding proceedings. And in responding to those considerations, the line that we drew was that was intervention on the merits on appeal. So where the USPTO intervened on the merits on appeal, we decided that we would not grant termination there. But for cases where that didn't happen, we granted joint motions to terminate. So I don't think Polaris can argue that it wasn't treated the same as those other similarly situated parties, namely Apotex and Aristocrat.
Okay, so let me get something straight. For those other cases where the PTO did not intervene on the merits in appeal, and then after the Arthrex Supreme Court decision, I guess, resurrected final written decisions in all of these other IPRs, the board in those cases nevertheless went ahead and granted the motion to terminate the proceeding, even though there was, in effect, a final written decision back on the books?
So at the time the board granted the joint motion to terminate those cases, Arthrex had not been decided yet. The Supreme Court Arthrex decision had not come out yet.
Okay.
So at that point, the final written decision stood vacated.
The status where they were still vacated.
Yes.
Because this decision was pending before the Supreme Court?
Correct. So
didn't they have an opportunity here during that interim period to do the same thing?
Yes.
So I thought you were answering us in terms of what the distinction is between this case and those.
So at that point, the distinction is still the same. At that point, the USPTO had intervened on the merits. When the joint motion
had
intervened on the merits. So
okay.
We had the USPTO had intervened before this court's Arthrex decision, before the case were remanded back to the USPTO.
So for timing, just to make sure I understand, what you're saying is that for those cases in which the PTO had intervened on appeal in the first case that came before this court, before the Supreme Court's decision in Arthrex, the board just didn't rule on those motions to settle or motions to terminate. Instead, they just sat there pending, whereas for those cases where the USPTO did not intervene, those motions were ruled on.
That's correct. That's correct.
Thank you. Okay. All right. You want to move on to the merits?
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the merits, I'd like to first note that for Polaris to prevail on its appeal, it has to show that both of the constructions here were unreasonable. And I'd like to start off by saying that for the 993 patent discloses a solution relating to the control component, namely multiplexing a certain address and control signals on the control component so that it can control different memory configurations. That solution has very little to do with how the semiconductor memory component or the memory chips are packaged. Turning specifically to memory chips, as the parties agree, that term can refer to either a packaged IC or a single die. Polaris asserts that only the latter is consistent with the disclosure in the 993 specification, but in making that argument, it principally focuses on figure 2A, which is described as being an embodiment. And there is no indication within the specification that claim 2 was intended to be limited to figure 2A. On top of that...
Well, your friend seems to suggest that because this is a dependent claim and this is the only one, I mean... Isn't that a fair reading? If you look at the dependent claim, and you say, okay, what in the spec speaks to this particular dependent claim is your friend not making a fair point that the answer to that is 2A, full stop.
Well, Your Honor, I would agree with that part of the...
I don't know that you want to agree.
But well, also, what I would add is that there are important differences between Claim 2 and Figure 2A. So, for example, Figure 2A shows four memory chips. There's nothing on the face of Claim 2 that's limited to four memory chips. Figure 2A also shows a stacked arrangement. There's nothing in the claim that requires a stacked arrangement. So the specification, I think, the distinction between Figure 2A and Claim 2 indicates that Claim 2 is not limited to what's shown in Figure 2A.
Your opposing counsel brought up the background section, column 2,
yes,
as somehow guiding the reader to suggest that when we're talking about memory chips, we must be talking about a die, not a packaged IC. Do you have a response to that?
Your Honor, I completely disagree with that. This paragraph relates
to... Slow down.
Oh, I'm sorry. Your Honor, I would disagree with that. This paragraph describes a need for the controller to be able to control different configurations without increasing the number of pins on the controller. It doesn't speak to how the semiconductor... So it doesn't distinguish between multiple memory chips as packaged die being the ranks or those ranks being composed of individually packaged devices. There's no distinction drawn here between those two possibilities.
Anything further?
Your Honor, I just have one additional point that in this situation, we don't just have Figure 2A as being referred to as an embodiment. We also have, as the board noted, some interchangeable usage between the terms memory chip and semiconductor memory component. And so the idea that there's this sharp distinction between one component that's supposed to be packaged and one component that is not packaged, we would say that those passages essentially rebut that argument.
And as Judge Chen pointed out with your friend, there's a plain and ordinary meaning here that seems to go.
Yes, absolutely. So we would say under Thorner, because there's agreed upon plain ordinary meaning, Polaris must show some sort of either definition or disavow, and the passages that they have cited don't rise to that level.
I'll be honest, I didn't understand the argument you made about the seeming interchangeable use of the terms semiconductor memory module and memory chip. I mean, I don't understand how that fact, assuming that it's true, helps me understand the meaning of memory chip and why memory chip should be open to include a packaged IC.
Yeah, well, it's really in response to Polaris's argument. So Polaris is...
Slow down.
Oh, I'm sorry. Polaris is arguing that the specification consistently uses these terms, semiconductor memory component and memory chip, and consistently uses one to refer to a packaged device and one to refer to a device that is not packaged. And so if Polaris is right and there's this strict dichotomy, that would support their argument that memory chip is not packaged, semiconductor component is packaged. But as the board noted, since there's some interchangeable usage between these terms, then that dichotomy evaporates.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, as I said, we'll restore 2 minutes of your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will give back more than the added time in the next appeal.
Can I ask you a question about your motion to terminate? I understood you to be asking that the IPR be terminated full stop. And one option would have been to ask that it be terminated simply as to NVIDIA, right?
Correct.
But you didn't ask for it to be terminated simply as to NVIDIA. Instead asked that it be terminated full stop.
We asked for both, Your Honor, but NVIDIA had agreed not to participate in any event, so that was sort of a moot aspect of the motion.
The way 317 is written, you know, it has, the way 317 is written, it says shall be terminated with respect to any petitioner. The way it's written,
yes,
is, you know, specific to that scenario, at least the first sentence.
Okay. Correct, the first sentence, you're right.
Okay, thank you.
I do want to address the final judgment here. I think an important legal principle is that agency inaction can be treated as a denial by this court. We didn't brief that. We didn't see that issue coming, but there's lots of law on that point, and we'd be happy to.
So you agree with your friend that there's no problem with the final judgment in this case because it effectively denied it.
Yes.
It's done. Okay.
Yes. Okay. I do want to address the line that the my friend said has been drawn regarding intervention on the merits. That was never explained by the office until April of 2022, this year, in the solicitor's supplemental response brief. They never gave that to Polaris as an explanation for sitting on the joint motion and not ruling it. They never said that was a factor that mattered in the other joint motions that they did grant. And I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you.
But I'll stay here for the next case.
That would be fine. We'll call the next case. I don't know. We thank both sides, and that case is submitted.